This is Carolyn Cromings, and welcome to the Quit Getting Screwed podcast, where we talk about everything related to contractors, construction, and information to help you run better businesses. Hello, this is Carolyn Cromings, and welcome back to the Quit Getting Screwed podcast, where we learn all the ways not to get screwed in the construction industry. And today, we're going to talk all about subcontracts, which is really, if you haven't had a chance to check out the book, Quit Getting Screwed, it's available on Amazon, and it's got 20 chapters about all the bad shit that's in subcontracts. And we're going to talk about some of those things today with my guest, Ms. Caroline Beavers from CHB Legal. Good morning. How are you, Ms. Beavers?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. So before we dive into all this good stuff, tell us a little bit about yourself and how you kind of got into construction law and how you became the expert you are today.
Right. So I grew up in small town Arkansas. You could probably tell I don't have that very unaccented accent as most Coloradans have. So I'm originally from Arkansas. I grew up working on a rice and cattle farm with my father. Prior to that, I spent days upon days in the truck with him at construction sites as he was a residential construction builder. He gave up that life and went to work on the farm, and I joined him along with my brother, who's still working on the farm. I realized really quickly I wanted to be in air conditioning and not walk rice levees with snakes all around me. So that sort of told me, you know, I'm going to have to take my talents elsewhere, and that found me at the University of Arkansas. Then I got my MBA and my JD in Little Rock. And then I did what most type A normal functioning people do. I made a spreadsheet and I put five cities where I was trying to decide where I wanted to go take the bar, and Denver, Colorado fit most of the bill. And so I moved to Colorado, worked for a small construction defect firm, all in civil, but worked for that firm for a couple of years, and then went to another firm where I opened my own practice with a law partner. I have since, it's been about 3 years with her. I am now rolling out my new firm. It's primarily going to focus on general counsel type work for my construction professionals and business and real estate developers. Gotcha. And I'm here today.
Awesome. Yes, I know. Farming is a lot of hard physical labor. It's a lot of hard work. My dad was a farmer, and we had the family farm, and
yeah,
that did not interest me either.
I loved it for the tan, and you know, for that hard work and grit is ingrained in me, and I've carried that over into everything I do. You know, I won't be outworked, and that's sort of what I base my professional life on. Really, it definitely taught me a lot. But yeah, I wanted to be in the air conditioning, and that's where I found myself.
There's something to be said about that grit, especially with who our clients are, right? I think it really resonates because they're the same type of people.
Right, and I carry that over with my practice because as a small business owner, I'm sitting across the table from small and medium-sized business owners. You know, they're like my dad. So I'm doing everything in my power to protect them and put them in the best position to succeed because, you know, when they succeed, I succeed. And that's what we want. We want that collaborative working together to get to a greater good and a goal.
Yeah, which brings us to the topic today, like dangerous subcontracts.
It is hard out there. That would be the easiest way to describe it in one sentence. And it's sort of cyclical. I don't know if you've experienced that with how the negotiating these subcontracts happens, and you know, geographical as well. So you might go to San Francisco and have no leg to stand on, or the opposite compared to a Denver area, or compared to a Birmingham, Alabama contractor market. So it's definitely a constantly moving area, and it always is very case specific. And that's what I like, because I like to really dig in and learn about my contractors, including, you know, subcontractors.
Well, and I think, and we're going to jump in a second, but I think another thing is that where we can all gain some traction on subcontracts right now is the material escalation clauses. Mm-hmm. And definitely those have to be in a subcontract. Right. Otherwise, you're going to have to eat the increased cost.
Right. It's really opening up subcontractors who are the worst on the food chain to withstand any sort of cost escalation. And if we're seeing 10 to 12% increase from mid-January to mid-March, it's something that's it's crushing, it's soul crushing. It's going to really hurt a subcontractor. And the negotiating I've done since 2022 has started, even compared to 2021, is exponentially different in that the language, we hit it so hard. Cost escalation, if it goes up over, 2 to 3%, then the owner then covers it, because we can't, we're not built that way. Our subcontractors aren't built that way. They float, obviously within the bounds of the law, but at the same time, they don't have the money that these developers and these contractors have to the level,
No, and rightfully so. If you're going to move forward building in this volatile market, it should be your risk, not the subcontractor's risk to cover that.
Right. And, contracts, you see so much floating around out there. Your number one priority, just read it. Have somebody read it for you. That's always my thing. If you can be proactive, I tell my subcontractors and my GCs to be proactive. Let's review it. Let's read it on the front end. Let's understand what it means and play through some scenarios and walk through the provisions and go from there. You don't know what you don't know, and you can't predict the future or the weather. But it's one of those things that you can be proactive and save yourself some heartache. In this business, there's going to be some regardless, but it helps. And it's a very low cost at that front end compared to the potential cost down the road.
I agree. And I think a contract has a job, right? Mm-hmm. And it's supposed to manage expectations, and it doesn't do a very good job if nobody can understand what it says.
Right.
So, these things have gotten written in such a way that even if they read them, they don't know what the hell they mean, because most of the time it takes me 2 hours to sit here and figure out what they mean.
Right. Yeah. It's a playbook, essentially. And I say you always need a playbook. You always need to know all the playbooks involved. That's another issue that comes up with the prime contract. But as an attorney, I think we've gotten so stuck in our ways of thinking and writing that we make it more difficult. But it's a two-way street. If a subcontractor comes in and says to me, I want a three-page subcontractor agreement, just give me something simple, then we have to make the decision of what we remove. Yeah. And it pumps up the jam quite a bit.
No, but I do think that for 10 or 12 pages, you could get a decent subcontract, because most of these subcontracts say the same thing over and over again for 50 pages.
Yep.
Well, just say it once in 10 and clear, and be, and actually, the clearer it is, the more likely it is to be enforced. So just spit it out.
Right, right. No, I couldn't agree more. There should be a level of simplification that is definitely missing in the contracting world that would save us all a lot of time. But that's not necessarily the nature of the beast that we're living in. It's document heavy, fast paced. Technology, if it's done anything, it's allowed people to make more decisions on the spot. And I don't think that's always a good thing,
Yeah. So do you remember the first time you read a subcontract?
I think probably the first time I did review a subcontract was in law school. I had a unique experience where I did more transactional clerkships. I worked for a large department store based out of Little Rock, Arkansas. Read through these subcontracts as an anchor landlord, coming from a position of extreme influence and power. It was an interesting way to look at those subcontract agreements. So I probably thought way different than I do now, because I'm typically lower on the food chain with my guys. I think it still is too long. Those subcontracts were too long. Payment provisions are a big sticking point for me. Yeah. If you can't figure out the software that the GC is requiring for you to submit payment to, that's a problem. If you get behind 1 month, if it's net 30, oh crap, we missed this payment period. Boom, you're 60 months. Another you're 60 month. Weeks yeah. out. I mean, 60 yeah. days out. You can't withstand that. And that's one of those things that I think you really have to know on the front end. Okay, this is how we submit invoices. I think the days depending on how you're scaling your business, I think the days of submitting a QuickBooks template specific invoice saying this is how much you owe, line item one, line item two, line item three, submit, then boom, electronic fund transfer. They're just not going to do that. They're going to make you work for it.
No, I agree. Okay, so, and I have another note before we dive into the most dangerous provisions. I want to know if you've been seeing this as well. So I've had several occasions of somebody hacking my sub's emails and sending different payment instructions to the general contractor. And then the general contractor then pays. Have you had that happen, and what have you been doing?
I have seen variations of that. That being one of the ways that I've seen it happen. All of our banks are really pushing call for wire instructions. Don't use a wire instruction if it comes over the email. Unfortunately, the level of sophistication doesn't necessarily play into a subcontractor's overhead picture when they're looking at, oh, do I need security? I've been known to be a clicker from time to time. If I get a link that comes through on an email, I might click on that, and that starts the whole ball rolling. And I think that's one of those things that you really should consider as a small business owner myself. I have internet security through an IT company, and it gives me such peace of mind. But yeah, I've seen that, and it's another way to kick things into litigation. You know, another way to make everybody.
And that's the next question. What is the legal ramifications? Because I'm not paid, right?
Right. Yeah. So I think there's fraud. There's all conversion. There's all, you name it. And it's, you might go after this pie in the sky person that nobody could put a face to the name that's off in some other country. But guess what? Guess who you're really going to be fighting against across the table? The sub and the GC and the owner. They're all going to be involved in this. It's all going to be drummed up costs and fees. And it's, at the end of the day, it's very upsetting and heartbreaking for a lot of people because it's a new threat that we're just learning about.
No, I agree. And I'm not sure how it would play out if somebody filed a lien or how that would work because they did pay, but not to the right. I don't even know how that would play out.
I would be very curious how that would play out. And obviously you'd start with the lien statutes and just read like down to a T the every single word and phrase that you would look at, okay, what is receipt? Because it's just the way the statute works.
Well, if you signed a lien waiver or a lien release, and then I think you're out, right? So there's a lot of interesting nuances to it.
Somehow. Right, and it's receipt of payment. Well, is that a waiver if it's a conditional?
Exactly.
You know, it just really depends. And each scenario is so different, but yeah, that's happening. You know, I've gotten a few emails of proposed scopes of work where they've said, hey, can you hold this $100,000 check in trust for me? And it's like, not today, Satan. You know, it's just not something I'm willing to do because it's part of that whole racket.
No, and it's been going around for years.
Yep.
And you would hold it for months and then pay it and it would still come back withdrawn. And then you're on the hook for this $100,000.
Yeah. Yep.
No.
Nope.
Definitely. Nope.
Yeah.
Okay. So, in your mind, what are probably the three most dangerous things in most subcontracts?
You know, I kind of have gone back and forth over these items. There are some that are helped by statutory provisions, depending on state specific. Obviously, this is exclusively as to Colorado. You know, what's enforceable, what's not. You know, you have some states where broad versus limited indemnity is not enforceable. You've got anti-indemnity statutes. So I think indemnity is a big one because there is a bit of a nuance as to, look, Colorado doesn't allow broad for construction contracts. Pretty set on that. However, if you add some language into the contract that says in whole or in part negligent, you could be potentially on the hook for not your comparative negligence, your piece. So let's say you're 75% negligent. Let's say your GC is 25% or whatever. You'd be on the hook for all of that depending on how that language is put together. So you want to say everybody's responsible for their own negligence. I've actually got a client right now where I'm going back and forth with another attorney about the indemnity provisions, and we don't want to be indemnified for our own negligence, our own willful conduct, anything like that. We want it just strictly mirrored because that's fair. And I think if you can operate under that approach, you'll get a lot further with people than fire and brimstone. You're not going to get indemnified for your own negligence. It should be your proportional share. And that's what I always push. So I think that's a big one. You're not allowed broad in construction in Colorado. But like I said, the language can change things. 75% versus 100% still makes a difference, especially if you're a subcontractor that doesn't have a lot of money coming in. I'd say the other provision that I always look to, it's about payment terms, pay if paid versus paid when paid. It's not if, but when. So if I'm very anti, do not touch it. If it's a pay if paid provisions, I exclude those from all of my provisions. Anytime I add an additional list of exclusions in a contract revision, I add that, excluding all pay if paid provisions, because they could easily not ever pay you. Pay when paid is different in that eventually, within a reasonable time, depending on what state you're in, determines the time frame. But when versus if, I'm more comfortable with when.
So what happens, though, if you're under a pay when paid clause and they don't get paid for 6 months, a year?
Right. And I think that's one of the things you have to look at. So we look at our subcontractors from the very beginning. You know, you've got you've got subcontractors that are elephants, and then you've got subcontractors that are house cats. Both are very important and make our construction business run and move forward and helpful for, you know, supply and demand. Mm-hmm. But if you're a subcontractor that is, you know, maybe taking a few big jobs a year and does smaller projects, you know, smaller crews, and it's all subjective what you mean by small versus large subcontractors. But what you have to look at is, can you withstand that float for that long? And most can't. I mean, it's a great time to be in construction, but at the same time, 6 months of non-payment on your, so you say, I'm going to take this big project. This is the huge project I'm getting. This is going to make my year. And then that single project, when you forego other smaller projects that might have cumulatively added up to half or maybe even that full amount, you're in big trouble, you know, because your accounts payable don't stop.
No, exactly. And you can't stop the job either.
No, exactly. Because it's not triggering, it doesn't trigger the requirement for payment. So there's no breach. So you can't say we would reserve the right to stop work upon non-payment. Well, the duty is not there yet. So it's all
paid yet.
Right.
Yes. And so like in Texas, a pay if paid is not, but a pay when is. And then they actually made this rule that if the owner hasn't paid the GC for 45 days and it's not your fault, you can write a letter saying you don't want it enforced against you.
Right.
It doesn't work very well in real life, but sounds like a good idea in theory.
It rarely does. I love these ideas and these statutory language updates that I'm like, oh, this could really help. And then in actuality, there's very few things that really work out the way you intended
them to.
They
just say, oh, the owner's considering assessing liquidated damages and you're part of that. So, you know.
It doesn't matter. Yeah, exactly. So the demand's not worth the paper it's written on.
Exactly.
Yeah. So
I agree, pay when paid.
Right. And I'd say the other one, I'm a big stickler, and I already kind of briefly mentioned it, the prime contract responsibilities. I cannot tell you how many times I've had a subcontractor that is so excited, so keen to get this job. There's a half-page list of exhibits, a defined contract document, things they've never seen, plans, prime contract, general terms and conditions, all of that. And they say, let's sign it. Let's do this. And I say, no, hold on a second. We need to see the prime contract documents, because you don't know what you're, you know, entering into, because you're going to be held to that standard. You might say no LDs. You might say no consequential, all of this stuff. But if the contract,
something different.
Yeah, and it governs. They'll right on that first page, it'll say in any ambiguity, any conflict, this is the document that governs, and it is the prime contract. It is not your subcontract. It is not. It will not be. So I think that's a big one for me as well.
Have you seen the and that's reasonably inferred? Have you seen that label?
I'm seeing that occasionally, and that I see that in a lot of different. What specific type clause are you talking about?
So it says this contract is all, you're supposed to do the work and the plans, the specs, and anything else that could be reasonably inferred.
Okay, so that's a big one for me. That's scope creep to me. That
Yeah,
will is a chill down my spine.
I agree.
Yeah,
Because who gets to reasonably infer and what is reasonable? Like, I'm the,
you should
yeah.
reasonably expect that there's going to be asbestos in this property because it was built in 1955. So because you didn't add that as a line item and didn't add to that scope, you're on the hook for this. That's, I would call that reasonably inferred if I were them, you
Exactly.
know?
Exactly. So I was like, if I have everything in writing, what should have to be reasonably inferred?
Right.
Nothing.
Nothing. Yeah, and that's another big part of, putting scopes together. I've seen so anytime I get so I work with some homeowners and some property owners as well. So I'll get some weird scope, crappy scopes come in where it's like two line items, materials, labor, boom, boom, $55,000. They're like, they put a lien on my property for $55,000. I'm like, this should, number one, they should not have submitted a scope like this. Number two, they don't have the backup data to substantiate those amounts. But at the same time, we've already started this train. Wouldn't you know it? You're the owner wants to refinance to take advantage of these rates. Boom. Roasted. Now you're over a barrel.
Yeah, no, I know. And then I've had a real, a lot of the times I see that people don't understand that they're not hired to do their bid, right?
Right.
And the scope could be
Yeah.
completely different.
Right.
And they just sign it as if it's the same thing, and like makes me cringe.
But if you really, you think about it, and we all have this in our nature, as small business owners, it's we're excited to get this work. This is our hard work come to fruition. And I firmly believe, and this is a saying my dad always told me, there are some people you cannot afford to do business with. And you have to think about your gut. And if your gut's telling you this isn't right, this doesn't smell right, then you need to walk away. And that's an ego decision. And it's
No, I can
hard.
tell.
We've all, everybody in this
No,
room has
and
that. We
I
all
tell
got
my guys all the
ego.
time, you know how many guys walk into my office saying, I knew I shouldn't have done that job. I knew I should.
Right.
At the very beginning, they knew. At the very beginning, they
Yeah.
did it
It's,
anyways.
I have that so many times as well. And then on the, when you're in 6 months into litigation, principled, making principled decisions
Usually like the
changes
bill
real
that
quick
comes
when
with
they get
principal
a,
decisions.
yeah, principled gets your purse stolen,
Exactly. And I try to be very upfront with my clients that, like, you don't want to go spend your money on growing your business. Principal is not where you want to be. The best you can
No,
hope for in
yeah.
court is to break even. And most 99% of the time, that does not happen.
And I will be very honest with you. I think a lot of the system in place is leaves a lot to be desired and is currently broken to where it does not benefit just about anybody to go to litigation because you will probably you could win, but you'll still
Exactly.
lose,
You're never going to get back your lost time. You could have been doing something else. Yeah. And so, okay. So I'm guessing it's the same in Colorado as in Texas. Is that when you get in front of a judge, they have no idea how the construction industry works. So you not only have to do the industry and then the law. I mean, has that been your experience as well?
Judges, it's a pipe dream to think you're going to get a judge or even a mediator that or arbitrator that is well versed in the construction industry. So you're essentially teaching them, and there are some things that are intangible items that are just understood by the nuances of the construction industry. Yeah, I mean, the majority of my cases that have gone pretty deep into litigation were before non-construction. It's just very, it's virtually unheard of. It's your criminal attorney.
Yeah,
I'm trying to think of other areas, but it's just
mostly personal
not
injury, but it's not
construction.
because, like, even if you follow, like, what my experience is, even if you follow all of the steps to have a valid lien, the judges are still like, oh, the owner's paying twice. This is not fair. This is not equitable. How can this be right? You don't even have a contract with the owner, and you're like, oh my God, this is since the founding of our country that liens have existed, and you have no idea what they are
Right.
or how they work.
Yeah. And you know, liens are confusing for even attorneys. There's so many different little things that go into factoring, whether it's enforceable, whether you filed it in time, all the deadlines, you know, different states. I think Wyoming and a couple others have we have to tell you that we can lien your property at some point down the road. So it's just all different and so many moving parts to it that I think the lien law is very confusing. And at the same time, you know, then you have to analyze, okay, well, what was the value of the work you did provide? Oh, and at the same time, you've got a homeowner or a property owner that says, I'm trying to refinance. I'm trying to sell this property. Wait, you're telling me I can't sell it while this lien is on the property? Well, get it off. Well, that's going to be 125% in Colorado, or a surety bond doing the same thing. Well, I have to pay what? I don't have that money. You know,
No, I know. And so we've kind of really, especially our courts were backed up in Texas for a long time, but then even more so after COVID. And so I've really found arbitration, even though it's more expensive on the front end, to be almost a more efficient option, because at least you can get it done in under a year.
And you don't have to necessarily follow all the rules of evidence.
Absolutely.
Which I prefer. It is more costly on the front end. You know, you've got those big conglomerate arbitration companies that we're talking, oh, okay, the claim is over 100,000. We're talking 7,500 to just get everything going. And it's like, that's a hard one for a lot of people, especially if you're not getting paid.
Exactly. But then in the long run, it's so much shorter. You don't get discovery disputes. You can just really get to the heart of the dispute and have somebody decide.
I am very brass tacks when it comes to disputes. I do everything in my power to keep my clients out of litigation because I don't think it's beneficial to anyone. Like I said, sitting in front of my clients, whether virtual or in person at my office, it's what are you forgoing today and for the next year and a half that you will be forgoing because you're in litigation? Is it worth that? Is that principal hill that you're going to stand on worth it? Probably not. Is your relationship with your family, you know, all the stress? Because it's like, okay, I know you're already stressed. Let's maybe hit the easy button, simplify it, and really try to work on something.
Yeah, that's not exactly
that
you want,
we can live with.
But it's not at the end of the day. Because, I mean, like, yes, your case looks so clear to you, but you have no idea what attorneys can make it look like, right? We're good at our jobs.
I don't give guarantees. If I did, I would be out the door to the 7-Eleven down the street and buy a lottery ticket because I could be able to tell the future. I could not tell the future. I don't. What side is the jury going to wake up on the day of trial, or the judge? You know, it's
no. And if you're a residential contractor, those pictures of like the small scratches blown up, and they're all like, "Oh my God, I can't believe you left the house that way."
I'll be honest, you know, you get those punch list items where it just kind of makes you laugh. It's just like, oh, because, I mean, as someone who this morning, don't get me wrong, I'm very thorough, but this morning forgot to put the coffee pot underneath the coffee dispenser. You know, I'm not going to notice this tiny little scratch on the seedy underbelly of the railing of the stairs, you know. And
but if we get a big picture of
that.
It. And be like, can you believe this contractor left it this? I mean, it just melts.
I would say punitive damages.
Even if it's a punch list, like I said, all of those things are small things that you would finish in punch. You just didn't get a chance to do it. And they don't understand what that is or what that means.
Right. And, you know, it's all about, you know, getting the contract understandable for people to understand expectations. If you can understand expectations and you can work with other people, I think a lot of it is interpersonal skills. You know, there are people that are going to take projects or work with other parties that are good to work with and they've established a good rapport and a good relationship with. You know, those can backfire because relationships, when money's involved, when high stress is involved, those can deteriorate quickly. However, it's good to have those relationships and to work together and you know, understand what the contract documents mean for both sides.
Yeah, absolutely. And on the residential or commercial, I mean, we're a lot less likely to end up in a dispute if both parties understand what they're supposed to do.
Right. And understand what it would cost if you can't resolve it.
Exactly. Nobody wants to know what that actually looks like, right? All sounds good in theory until you're writing the huge checks for litigation.
I've never been enamored with being in the courtroom because I know it's just a house of cards. As a, like, small business owners, it's your worst nightmare. If you're a small business owner, you cannot withstand it. the cost, the stress, you're foregoing business. You know?
Exactly. Much rather spend your business, like money, growing your business and not dealing with this.
Right. I mean, scared money don't make money, but at the same time, you need to be able to compromise and figure something out to fight another day.
So on the subcontracts, how successful have your clients been in negotiating fairer terms in the subcontract?
You know, earlier I made that comparison from 2021 to 2022. I have seen more success in 2021 with negotiating contracts for my subcontractors because they had a little more bargaining power. I think this price escalation has really thrown things for a loop. And I think people are trying to figure out how to put things together to make it work for everyone involved. And again, you're lower end of the food chain, but at the same time, you know, I've got a client who the owner is taking out an SBA loan. So there's a lot of provisions that have to be followed, very specific documentation. So that goes into the analysis, and you just want to protect your subcontractors. So it's a harder push, but it's definitely something that can be done because people are still building, even if material costs are astronomical. I constantly will see these stats all over the internet where it's, you know, an increase of from 188 square feet, a price per square foot from 120 2 years ago. It's just, it's crazy. It's not, I don't necessarily think it's sustainable, but at the same time, I think it's the world that we live in, and it becomes more of a cost benefit and risk analysis that I, as a very diplomatic person, I have a really good job of putting things in front of the client and saying, like, let's look at it based on this. Let's talk about this scenario. Can you withstand a 45-day net to get paid because the provisions are crazy and the SBA is requiring this, or, you know, the lender is requiring that? If your answer is I'm not sure, then maybe you don't risk it. But then it's like, oh, this might be a really big project. Kind of just working through a type of scenario that you have where clients keep asking those kinds of questions, and you kind of just have to work through it together and see where they end up.
Yeah. So another thing that I've seen in subcontracts is really on the change order provisions. Mm. Now being that if we can't decide on a price, you have to do the work anyways and figure it out later. What have kind of been your workarounds on that? Or if it's a big deal or not a big deal to the clients?
It can be. I often will have contracts where the best case scenario is a change order and the parties agree. The second scenario is the change order. The parties don't agree, and it becomes a directive. I lean towards the first option because depending on how long the project is, it could change again. And I think you kind of just have to look at it not in a vacuum. You have to look at it through the totality of the situation. If you've got a very complex piece of the scope coming up, or if you've, you know, put in enough of a cushion understanding that these potential escalations, it helps. But just generally speaking, you know, when I see a directive versus a change order, the owner it's always going to be in their best interest for the most part, I would say, to say, you know what, you're just doing it and we're going to figure it out later. And I just say, paper the crap out of that file, put everything together, get all your receipts together, get your ducks in a row, get them the documentation for the change, and just try your very best to keep it moving. You know,
so what I've been trying to do, and I haven't had it successful, I haven't had anybody take me up on it or realize what a big issue this is to formulate the formula of what it would be like labor and expenses plus a certain percentage.
Right. I think that's a fair option. And I've seen a carve out of that in contracts before where it's, you know, a plus whatever of whatever that is, and kind of considering what your overhead and profit is. But at the same time, that does take, you know, if you're in the thick of a project, it's really hard to get an owner to be like, yeah, I'm going to pay you more money plus a little bit over the top. It's really hard.
No, I know. Exactly. All right. So you have any other words of advice or anything for subcontractors in the realm of subcontracts or liens or anything?
My advice that I give all of my clients is be proactive. Paper, 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 put everything, write everything down, take lots of notes. I take a lot of notes. I think it's really important. Don't be afraid to walk away. I think a lot of our bad decisions come from a position of ego. You don't want to get in over your skis, and that's where you find yourself because you have people that rely on you. You have people that you got to make payroll. You've got to figure out, you've got to take care of your vendors, your suppliers, and you want to keep those relationships. One bad project can throw 20 years of a great vendor, material supplier, subcontractor out the window. Those relationships are crucial and they help you survive. And I think you just really have to build those relationships.
Yeah, I guess who gets to put front of the material line if there's a shortage?
Exactly. Who will allow you some credit if you don't? If you're kind of maxed out, or you know, it pays to have those relationships. I think that's another big thing to put into place. I mean, you'll realize who you're not wanting to do work with again pretty quickly.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for being on the podcast. I'm sure we'll have you on again, and maybe
That'd
we'll do
great.
A collection topic or something.
I'd love it.
I think we think a lot alike.
I would say so as well. Yeah, absolutely. No, I had a great time, and happy to help in any way I can.
Absolutely. And we'll put all your contact information in the show notes if somebody wants to reach out to you.
Sweet.
We'll know how to get a hold of you.
Awesome.
And then Chelsea will send you the link, and you'll have it as well. So,
all right.
Awesome. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much.
Uh-huh.
All right. Bye.
Bye. Thank you for listening to this episode of Quit Getting Screwed. I hope you found it helpful. If you like what you hear, please like us and follow our podcast. If you want further information, you can find us at subcontractorinstitute.com. We're also on Facebook, LinkedIn, and Instagram. And the book is available on Amazon. Thank you.